Hello everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Stats for Lefties. In this episode, I interview Cameron Archibald, who is an activist for the Scottish National Party and a policy and economics analyst for Modern Money Scotland. We had a great discussion about economics, Scottish independence, Kate Forbes, the S&P leadership contest. It was a really, really interesting discussion. I certainly learned a lot. I think you guys will too. Let's get into it. So it's now been 4 days since Humza Yousaf became first, SNP leader, and then I think 3 days since he became first minister. And you are the first SNP member I've had on this show. So I would be very interested to hear what prompted you to support the Scottish National Party, because for many people in England, I think it's not something people generally understand.
So obviously, for most of you listeners should know, we had the 2014 independence referendum in Scotland, which the SNP was able to push forward with their surprising pro-independence majority, with an SNP majority by itself under a sort of PR system. I had been pretty hooked onto the independence campaign on the basis of, well, two key principles. One is that I support independence because I believe in the principle that Scotland is a country, and, well, it's not a principle, it's a fact, and that countries should get the governments they vote for. And Scotland hasn't voted for the Conservatives since 1955, and that isn't real democracy, because on that basis we've had Conservative governments for the vast majority of our time. Over the last 70 years. So in my view, independence is a way of having a more stable democracy which reflects the will of the Scottish people. But what really inspired me within the independence campaign was, political activists will be able to tell you this, but when you're on a doorstep and you're knocking doors and you're part of a political party, you've really got to stick to a party script. So if your question is something you're uncomfortable with, or you don't agree with, you'd have to break party line, or you've got to make something up, which isn't really true to a real political standing. The Yes campaign was completely different. It was very much a people's campaign in the sense that we all were here together on the basis of independence, and we could combine different independence visions within that campaign. You can have a green vision, the SNP vision, a socialist vision, even a slightly right of center vision. It was inspiring to work with so many people who wanted to grasp change and challenge the British establishment. There's this joke I know in which an anarchist and a communist are in a bar. And the anarchist turns to the communist and asks, "Are you here for the revolution?" And the communist says, "I am." To which the anarchist says, "Listen here, buddy. I'll fight by your side for now to overcome the establishment. But after that, we've got our issues." So that's how it felt. It felt that we were campaigning next to people who wanted similar or slightly different change, but we're all together under a kind of people's movement, combined with different classes of people who want to take on the British establishment. We lost that, and that's when, with that loss, we were re-energized to take something else forward, and that's where support for the SNP basically was scooped up, and that's where I went.
So I am intrigued in particular, because obviously there were two other independence parties that got a big surge after the referendum, which were the Scottish Greens and the Scottish Socialist Party. I may have some questions about why you think the SSP has just disappeared into nothing. But why join the SNP and not those two? Because obviously, as you're a left-leaning person, the SNP is less left-leaning than those two. I think most people would agree.
So there's two elements to that. On a personal level, I was obviously very engaged with politics growing up in the very beginning of high school, because my family are very political. On the one hand, I've got my mum's side of the family and stepdad's side of the family, which are very pro-Labour. And on the other hand, I've got my dad and stepmom's side of the family, which are very pro-SNP. I met, growing up in Dundee, Joe Fitzpatrick, the SNP MSP, who is just an absolute lovely guy, and who, you know, despite being like just an idiot, like 15, 14 year old in Dundee, he gave me the time of day and spoke to me. And I really appreciated that, because he was a most politicians really, you have to like wait several weeks or months to even get a proper meeting with. But Joe always had the time and day for all the activists in Dundee. So on a personal level, he was amazing, and I loved that. And secondly, as well, I feel like for the SNP, to me, I guess this kind of goes to my personal journey. At first, the SNP were the party of independence, and that's where I moved to. But as I've grown older, going into education, going into, you know, policy analysis, and then developing that further with my own work at Modern Money Scotland, I've grown far heavier with my left-leaning roots, left-leaning political views and frameworks. And for me now, my policies are very much defined by social democratic, socialist views, to which I like to now push within the SNP under SNP Socialists and the SNP TUG group, which is the trade union group. So that's kind of where my journey went. I went with the SNP because they were the big pro-independence party. And as my kind of left-wing journey progressed, so did my left-wing activism within the SNP.
It certainly does feel as if there is a stereotype that's often said about young people, that we will get more right-wing as we get older. But in my experience, the truth, as in yours, has been actually the opposite, that I've gotten more left-wing as I've gotten older and more more involved in the capitalist hellscape that we live in, and seen more and more the need for social democratic policies.
I think there's interesting in research out there, at least from just kind of policy qualitative and quantitative data, which shows that in times of crisis, the theory of the older you are, the more conservative you'll become is complete bullshit. It's based on there's no data to back that up, really, or it's very shaky data. But in times of economic stability, at least for a mainstream class, you know, if other working class people are suffering, if the mainstream class and the majority of classes themselves are actually in stable conditions, they will see that as comfort and see that stability growing older, which may make them more right-wingers or older to maintain that sense of stability. Right now, we are living in a time of crisis. We are literally in a cost of living crisis. And it's no wonder that young people are simply not shifting to the right, and there's no political, quantitative or qualitative data to back that up.
I think it's very much a case of young people will maybe become more right-wing. It's not guaranteed. Obviously, sometimes one's material circumstances don't override one's morals or points of view. I mean, my dad and mum, they own their own home, but, you know, my dad votes Labour and always has done. But things like owning your own home, having, you know, a job that earns you a lot of money and you don't pay too much tax on, are things that are very important for endearing you to capitalism.
Yeah, I wish I had those things.
Yes, well, that's the thing. You know, this doesn't apply to my parents, because like my dad did not grow up rich or middle class. But as a side note, actually, like, this is one of the things that, like, I remember for like two decades now, there's been this debate over, are you working class if your parents grew up middle class but you definitely did not? And I speak from personal experience when I say I am not working class, even though I definitely couldn't describe my dad as having grown up that as middle class. So yes, that answers the question of why you joined the SNP. Obviously, this past month or so. It's been a very quick leadership contest. I guess we're used to the Labour parties, which are, you know, I remember the Welsh one, like Carwyn Jones declared he was standing down and it took them like half a year to elect a new guy. And the Tory one, obviously, maybe it felt longer because it never stopped. They always had a new one. But the SNP's was very quick.
I mean, it doesn't feel quick for me. I've, you know, as someone who's followed almost every hustings and looked at every blooming media headline throughout the entire campaign, it, honestly, it feels like a lifetime. But now that you've said that, like, Welsh Labour, like, took, what, half a year, did you say? My goodness, that makes me feel quite weak in comparison to what Welsh Labour folk go through.
As I remember very distinctly following it, yes, Carwyn Jones announced that he would retire on the 21st of April in 2018, and the actual Welsh Labour leader was announced on the 6th of December. Oh. So it wasn't, yeah, it was about half a year it took them to elect the new leader from the point of Carwyn resigns, Mark Drakeford comes in. And between Sturgeon announcing her resignation and Yusuf taking office, it's been like a month, pretty much.
I mean, I guess we just get things done in the SNP.
You do? Just... Well, I mean, I was going to say smaller nation, but then Wales is smaller. So, I mean, that makes no sense. The question is, many of us outside of Scotland and outside the SNP broadly have been utterly baffled that Kate Forbes managed to do so well. In the end, she got 48% of final preferences and 41% of first preferences, despite being, for listeners who hadn't seen, opposed to abortion, opposed to gay marriage, opposed to a ton of socially liberal concepts, which most people in Scotland are totally on board with. Why do you think she managed to do so well, despite those conservative views?
Oh, yeah, it's not amazing that she got that kind of level of support, but I would still welcome the fact that we have a BAME, open Republican, left-leaning candidate that won. But you're right, it's still a problem that we got to that stage. So I think there's two parts to it, and I think this is reflects the gradual change of the SNP membership. Under Alex Salmond and even John Swinney when he was leader, the SNP during the late 90s, early 2000s, took a big tent approach to their membership and to the political policy. So they essentially were very centre ground and they want to try and pull in both right and left wing voters. And I think to them, this was almost a benefit in the sense that the Labour Party were also moving to the centre too. And because the SNP had more kinder left-leaning policies on welfare, this made them more attractive traditional left-leaning voters who used to vote Labour. And that's how you could argue much of their success came within 2007, although others would argue it's about, you know, general competence of Labour at the time, but, you know, we're getting ahead of ourselves. So at that point, the SNP were quite a broad tent with different kind of memberships, members, you name it. Come 2014, when Alex Salmond resigns, Nicola Sturgeon then puts the SNP on a solid social democratic seating in regards to the SNP's values. And this is at a point as well, the SNP membership absolutely explodes. And I think it went something along the lines of like 30,000, 35,000, and then reached eventually over 100,000, and then has now gone back to roughly 70,000. So at that time, you have a wave of new members as well, but much of these new members reflecting much of the kind of social democratic values that a lot of Scots have helped kind of push with Nicola Sturgeon the SNP towards that direction. Kate Forbes is part of that old big tent crowd. She is one of the original right-leaning individuals who came into the SNP who probably felt quite fitting at the time under Alex Salmond, now suddenly within a party that is very largely social democratic. I did a research using Tim Bale's model. It's the model called the General Incentives Model that looks at party membership. And what I found, some obvious factors with the SNP. First of all, the SNP are overwhelmingly supportive of redistribution policies. That includes also reversing cuts to public services, and, you know, membership also holds pretty unfavorable views to big, large companies, especially when they're trying to, you know, exploit prices for themselves right now during the current crisis. And they were also very much, you know, the membership in favor of state interventionist policies. And I think that support never fell below 80% of the membership. But there is a catch, though. The research and that model, also by Tim Bale, I'd recommend anyone to look at it, also found that actually there's about 30, around one third of SNP members actually did hold some pretty strong socially conservative views. So we're talking about many of them supported the death penalty, many of them supported children learning traditional values. About one quarter of them also believed, you know, that we should be obeying authority, you know, certain degrees of censorship, and also stiffer sentences on criminals. Classic traditional conservative views. And it's unsurprising that this is also mainly a lot of older voters, part of that big tent that was attracted under Salmond and John Swinney. So I think that explains two things to us. One, it explains how many people voted Kate Forbes, because they are part of an old generation of members who are still there, they still have influence, and they still vote for Kate Forbes. Now, how did Kate Forbes get into the position of leadership? And that comes to a few things. First is, she was essentially heavily promoted by the SNP because of the fact that she was very deemed as very competent, very young, and someone up and coming in politics. And she really had her breakthrough when the former finance secretary, Derek Mackay, was basically expelled from the party and just left politics altogether. And then Kate Forbes, 6 hours before the budget is to be announced, steps forward and gives to her, you know, a pretty solid speech for someone who came in last second. And that gave her an absolute ton of credibility. And right there, that hugely swayed her image. And it also helped her when a lot of right-wing unionists were attacking her on her budget claims. And later on, it would turn out that she was right on these arguments. And a lot of them were kind of groveling and had to accept that they were wrong. The thing about that, though, is that despite her image being, I'm a great finance secretary, I'm smart of the numbers, in actuality, most of the numbers herself come from SPADs.
Special advisors, right? That's what SPADs means.
Yeah, exactly. They did most of the work, and she basically just said it. So they're right there, she's come across as competent, and her views had only been known in a sort of grey area. We know she spoke at a pro-life event. By pro-life, we mean anti-choice. Just, you know, years before the leadership election. And she was always very silent on her views and LGBT issues, and she kept it close to the knit. So she was never a blaring, you know, homophobe or transphobe or anything like that. She was very much self-aware to know to keep these views low until it came to the election, obviously. The second thing that gave her a lot of credibility was the commentariat. And we're talking about the media, Chris Dearen, Stephen Daisley, groups like Reform Scotland, the right-leaning groups and commentators gave her a lot of airtime, because obviously her sort of social fiscal agenda, to be more like David Cameron, something which she herself didn't deny being like, because she didn't mind that comparison, she, you know, that agenda worked in line with much of the commentariat. So it worked for her to kind of have that image overall. And the last point I'll make, because I know I've gone on for quite a bit, is, and it's quite a sad thing to say, and this is a fact I think sadly applies to all parties, but I genuinely think that if Hamza Yousaf was a white man, he probably would have got probably another between 5 to 10% of the vote. Because I think, whilst SNP members obviously aren't blaring racists, I think in all parties, and that includes the SNP, you'll find a small internal prejudice towards those who are just quite simply different to us. And I think that also applies to the SNP too. So combining these different factors of political approaches from the early 2000s to today, and the Big Tent approach, Kate Forbes' overall media push from right-wingers, and also being part of that Big Tent, and also a small percentage of, sadly, you know, SNP members being traditionally racist. Not all of them, by the way. I'm not trying to smear all SNP members. I'm talking about a very small percentage of maybe internal bias. I think that could explain a big degree of why Kate Forbes is where she is and how she got that much of the vote.
I think it's definitely true. There are two things that you made me think of when we were talking there. One was about social conservatism in the SNP membership. And I wonder if it reflects the fact that the SNP have taken on the sort of political position of Scottish Labour before 2010, in the sense that Scottish Labour was this hegemonic party, which, as a result, had a lot of people in its voter base who were socially conservative. I was looking up what people, UK Labour voters, thought of gay marriage in 2010, when the composition of the electorate was very different to now. And it's like there were about a third of UK Labour voters were against gay marriage, and now it's about 15%. And I do wonder if, like, because not only because people have changed their minds, but because there has been a lot of sort of self-sortition. People who are socially liberal have sorted out themselves away from the Tories and towards Labour, and people who are socially conservative have been like, I'm not a Labour person, I'm a Tory now. And I do wonder if that process has also happened with the SNP. I think it may have been accelerated by the formation of ALBA, because we've seen that big membership dip, and ALBA being formed by Alex, well, not by Alex Salmond, formed by someone else and he took over, but led by him, stole a lot of conservative, socially conservative nationalists away from the party. I think it was certainly a great irony that all those people leaving because they were angry at the Gender Recognition Act being reformed may have ended up elevating Humza Yousaf, who will defend it, as opposed to Kate Forbes, who couldn't care less.
I mean, it's on the polling side. I'll leave that to you, because obviously I'm my area of expertise is policy, and my other interest is obviously economics. But you do touch on a good main thing, which is the SNP's main threat in Scotland isn't the Conservatives; it's Labour. And if Kate Forbes had this argument that during the leadership election, the polls were showing she was more popular amongst her opponents than she was with compared to the others. Her point was, I can appeal to these voters, vote for me. The problem with that, though, was the voters she was appealing to were A, much older voters, and B, much more conservative. And even if those voters slightly liked her, they were never going to vote for her anyway, because their vote is very much embedded within the Conservative Party. So that the main threat is, of course, Labour, because it's that working class, these working class urban areas, which the SNP made their original gains in the first place. And that's where their biggest threat can come back through Labour again. So I guess you touch on a pretty solid point there. I couldn't go any further on the polling theory or analysis. I'll leave that to you as the expert on that. But I think you do touch on a very solid point there.
It was a very strange argument for her and her supporters to make, because if you're a leader trying to become leader of an opposition party, like, and your party has just lost a battle election, like, people made this argument for Starmer. Like, we've just lost in a landslide, because Labour did. There's no one can seriously contest that happened. So we do not have enough voters on our side to be in government. So we can't just look at who appeals to our own voters. We have to look at who even appeals to even just a minority of the opposition, whether that was the Lib Dems or the Conservatives. But it's a very strange argument for a party of government to make, to say the plurality of people who put us into government multiple times, who've given us multiple landslide victories in UK elections, these people, their opinions don't matter. What matters is the 15% of people who vote Tory. Those people are the people we should be appealing to. It's like, no, you've created a very strong social coalition. If you are in power, your priority should be holding it together, because it has worked. It's delivered. Oh, it's a wide, very powerful coalition of voters that has delivered, like, uniform success across Scotland. Like, it's I remember it's remember trying to explain to people that, like, it's very unusual for the S&P to be for the S&P support to be so geographically even, because in the South you'll have, you know, a big victory by the Tories or Labour, but there'll be huge pockets of areas that are so strongly Labour and Tory that they will not budge. But when the S&P wins big, like 2019 or 2015, it wins everywhere. And that's a phenomenal coalition. Oh, sorry, go on.
That's the first past the post. I mean, that in a big way is first past the post, though. I mean, you see this huge, the map of Scotland being basically completely yellow. But in actual fairness, so like as a percentage of the vote, it's usually between 40% to 50%. 50 being the peak in 2015, and 40 kind of being the sort of kind of lower end, but still somewhat successful. And the worst for the SNP being 2017, I believe, where I think they fell to 37%. But yeah. I think there's another thing for Kate Forbes, though, as well, is you know, she talks about her own popularity amongst you know, other opponents, but what she didn't mention was that when it came to membership polling, her support almost collapsed based on two factors. First of all, Humza Yousaf was more popular with SNP members. When it came to the actual polling of SNP members who could vote, which was the whole thing of trying to win, not an election, not an actual general election, Humza was pretty far ahead. And secondly, you know what? Kate could have won that. Kate could have won that leadership election if she had done two things. First of all, if she had seen the shift, policy shift going to the left and not try and push that back. At least try either keep a Sturgeonist mainstream approach by changing nothing, continuing kind of Sturgeon's kind of more soft social democratic approaches. And also not being blatantly homophobic or transphobic or any of these awful views against equality, and also being against choice. And on the very first day of our campaign, again, she was the leading figure, the most likely to win, and she completely blew it by saying, I would vote against gay marriage. I would not extend the rights of women when it comes to defending on buffer zones, for example. She said she wanted to take a balanced approach. Well, I'm sorry. You defend women's safety and mental health going into an abortion clinic, or you don't. There's no balance to it. So she had all the cards in her hand, and then she put a lighter to it and threw them down on the table.
It was so unbelievably baffling, even from a political competence perspective, which was supposed to be her thing.
She gave it all up.
Yeah, she gave it all up. She was a finance minister in the Scottish government. She was the front runner to be first minister. And now she's a backbencher with no power or influence. And the only reason is because she just could not keep her private opposition to gay marriage or abortion rights to herself. And it's not like anybody was forcing her to say this. Nobody, I think, had even considered that the finance minister of the SNP might be against gay marriage. Just not something that would have come up. And so she brought it up of her own accord. And it just feels to me as like a lot of people were going around saying, well, this is a private belief, doesn't matter. It's only her personal belief. It's not going to affect her votes. And there are many reasons why that's nonsense. But for me, the main reason why it was obviously nonsense is that she brought it up herself.
Yeah. She literally said she would vote against equality, though. Like, she says, oh, it's my private view. So how would you vote on it? Oh, I'd vote against it. It's like, oh, okay, amazing. Well, great
but
logic
it's like,
there.
This is something that is so fundamental to her character and personal sense of being that she, despite the obvious political footfalls here, she had to say it. Because she's like, I have to tell you who I am. It's so important to me. I just can't hold it in a second longer. And that's something that's not a person you want in power, because that's someone who cannot control their personal beliefs.
I mean, basically, she's like a reverse version of Keir Starmer. Keir Starmer lied and presented competent Corbynism, and then won, and then told everyone, hey, everyone, I lied, I'm right-wing, sorry, Also, all those lefties and progressives have fought so hard to try their best for the Labour Party. I'm getting rid of them. Ba-ba-ba. And then Kate Forbes, on the other hand, went, "Hi, everyone. I'm actually really evil. Please vote for me." And then she went, "Oh, no, no, oh, no, sorry, the other way around. I was meant to say I'm good first, then I met to Lang later on." So, yeah, basically, I think for future reference, I don't think she will go for it again. But if she does, I would say if she wants to be really right-wing and pretend to be left, Keir Starmer, an excellent case study for her to look at.
I do wonder if, like, maybe there was a little part of her that was like, I need to pitch to the right because I'm trying to get Conservative voters. That's my whole plan. But even if you ignore the fact that those people weren't voting in the election, Scottish Conservative voters, like, that electoral coalition is not the extreme right-wing group that it was, say, 20 years ago. Because Ruth Davidson specifically cultivated an electoral coalition that was a little bit more socially liberal. And even still, they are very strong in the union, but the Scottish Conservative voter base, obviously the MSP group, very anti-trans rights, all this stuff, but their electoral coalition is not the hard right group, I think, that it is in the South. But then you'd know a little bit more than me about Scottish politics.
No, I think that's true. And I think Pierre Lynch, who's really big on political ideology, based at the University of Stirling, who I also had the privilege of working under during my time there, he made the point that because the Scottish politics is slightly, in terms of, you know, mainstream views, is centre-left, not left-wing. I'm not going to say that Scots are just naturally these incredible intellects of left-wing heroes. We're not. But the mainstream discussion is to the centre-left, which means, in a sense, the SNP is a centrist party from a Scottish political perspective, whereas the Greens are the left, and Labour and the Conservative, Labour maybe somewhere close to the centre themselves, or kind of confusing right now between Scottish Labour and UK Labour, and the Conservatives to, like, the proper right. So on that base point, yeah, there's certainly something there.
So we should move on to the next question. By the time of the next Scottish election in 2026, there was some talk that there might be a snap election, but with Yusuf getting every SNP MP and MSP and the Greens, I don't think that's going to happen. So by the time of 2026, the SNP will have been in government for 19 years, which is longer than any UK government has been in office since the 19th century. The only people who have beaten that record are Welsh Labour. People in England, from my experience, have come to see the SNP government as like a law of nature. Just like Scotland, government is SNP. It's almost impossible to imagine anybody else up there. Do you think there is a serious prospect of the SNP being voted out in 2026? I mean, like, out of government, not just out of a clear majority.
Okay, so I'm going to give my... Okay, this depends on three factors. Three kind of key pillars what the SNP need to kind of focus on if they want to maintain electoral victory. I think it'll be very hard for them to get majority, but that doesn't rule out the fact they could still be in government. So what are those kind of three key pillars they've got to keep in mind? The first one is moments, political moments, in that often in crisis, or just in British politics as a whole, the SNP effectively receive the kiss of life. So for example, 2014 saw the SNP surge hugely for support. And because of First Past the Post, that was like, that escalated to the point where they got like over 90% of seats in Scotland, in one country as a whole, which is wild. And then, of course, Brexit happened. And not only did that help the SNP further, but also gave that extra support for independence to kind of stabilize between 45 to 50%. Then you have general Conservative election victories. Scots, you know, obviously haven't voted the Conservatives in a long time, 1955 to be precise, and seeing the likes of Theresa May and even worse, Boris Johnson get elected, whilst in Scotland we didn't vote for that, for many of us is like, oh, great, fantastic. Again, gave a lot of weight to the SNP. And then, of course, there's other moments like Section 35, when the UK government blocked the Scottish government from reforming the Gender Recognition Act to make trans lives just that little bit easier in Scotland, to change the policy, their actual documents to be recognised as being trans. When that was blocked, many people, despite your views on GRA reform, that was a direct attack on Scottish democracy, and that gave the SNP in that moment the extra support. So the SNP, despite being the party of government in Scotland, have often had the benefits of a party that's almost in opposition, because the SNP are in a sense in opposition against Westminster and the UK government. So it's this really odd balance of we are essentially the establishment, but we benefit from oppositional politics. So it's quite rare. You don't really get that often in mainstream Western democracies. And then this then goes to a second point, and that is the SNP's core vote. And if you were to look at polling data today, which shows how much how strongly you hold views on independence, it's almost like a kind of a U skate ramp, skate ramp. So basically, on the left, if the left was yes voters are like almost all of them are like 10%. Like, we are hardcore yes voters. We're not shifting. These are our views. And at the very far right, not politically, just in the polling data, you'll find no voters are very firm. No, we are not moving. We are unionists, and we are not shifting that. And then in the middle, There's very little gap for people who are in different polling spots. There's not a big chunk of soft voters in that grouping. The hardcore voters are very large, and they're very much to those sides. For the SNP, that means they've got about between 35 to 45% of a hardcore Indy vote. That vote will depend on the mood, depend on the engagement of independence voters, and depend on what's happening in politics as a whole. In 2017, I feel the SNP didn't get a really clarified message out. You could argue were quite complacent, and that's where they kind of fell to that kind of mid-30.
I would add, from a numerical perspective, one of the things that was notable about 2017 in Scotland was collapsing turnout, as opposed to the actual swing either way, and a big chunk of that was the SNP vote just going down. I'm pretty sure the Scottish Labour vote only rose by something like 10,000, 20,000 votes, and that was enough to give them another 6 seats, in large part because the SNP vote went down. Because, yeah, it was a sense of like no clear message, complacency, not a clear distinction from a resurgent UK-wide left Labour.
And I feel like for many people as well, it was a case of, are we an independence party or are we a European party? And I feel like I pulled the viewer both. I asked my personal view, but for a lot that wasn't super clear. But yeah, so that was our low point, and that's where our hardcore support was still there, but it didn't have a great result. We still won, but it wasn't a great result. Then in 2021, when we had the Holyrood election, we actually did, in comparison to what could have been, we did really, really good. We're only one seat short of a majority. And actually, a really positive outcome of that was the SNP Green kind of deal. And that's when we see independent support kind of getting close to the high point, that hardcore support turning out and giving the SNP a pretty solid victory. So that's the second pillar. And to kind of quickly finish up on this question, the next pillar is progressive image. How the SNP are viewed and seen is a big point as to how much Labour voters are going to attract, because it's a Labour core vote, historic Labour core vote, which they won over and which made them so politically dominant. And they've got to hold that. If under Kate Forbes we were shifted to the right, and Labour, even just under Anna Sauer, took moderate leaps to the left as a Scottish image, putting aside Keir Starmer, a lot of SNP voters who are formerly Labour might go, well, I'm actually going to go back to the party which represents a bit more working class values. So those are the three pillars you have there, essentially. It depends on political moments, so what's happening at the time that could benefit the SNP. the SNP's hardcore vote and making sure they actually get out there, assuming they stay strong for independence. And I don't think there's much to suggest it's going anywhere anytime soon. And making sure the SNP remain a progressive party, you know, since pushed by Nicola Sturgeon. If the SNP can get a balance of all three, then the chances of them being again with the Greens in a pro-Indy, you know, pro-Indy parliament or an SNP minority government are still quite likely. But if they don't get that balance right, then come 2026, we could actually quite easily see a Tory Lib Dem grouping backing a Labour minority administration, unofficially or officially. And I think it's safe to say that it's unlikely we'll see an SNP majority for a long time. That, as I think you put it to me, that was a mathematical fluke. Now, again, I'm not the polling expert in that, so I'll leave that to you and others to kind of discuss that. But either way, politically, I just don't see a majority happening.
The 2011 majority win was a function partly of it preceded the Greens' rise. Because obviously it was pre-2014, the SNP were winning elections but didn't have a huge surge in membership, active engaged membership, or a sort of hardcore block of voters. And also there was less unionist tactical voting because referendum of independence hadn't happened yet. But what that meant was the SNP got a ton of list seats in the PR section on the regional list. And that was what provided them with their majority in 2011, because they didn't actually get an enormous sweep of constituency seats in 2011. They actually did better in constituency seats in 2021 than they did in 2011. Much better. But because the list vote has gone down so much and the Greens have started taking more and more list seats, as have the Tories and Labour, that has been sort of counteracted. In a sense, 2011 was the electoral system got caught by surprise. I know I'm speaking about the system like it's alive, but it was almost like it didn't quite know how to process this massive transformation. And now the system has kind of reached an equilibrium where it's functioning pretty well. I mean, the SNP came within one seat of a majority on the basis of less than 50% in 2021. So it got very close, but it did deny them a majority, which is what it's, you know, whether you know, it's what it's supposed to do. That's its function.
I'm quite happy with that, because and the outcome of that was actually building political alliances with progressives and actually seeing the SNP move to the left. So if that can happen again, either way, if the SNP maintain that seat, or more likely less seats, but the Greens get gain, then I still hope that actually that kind of progressive alliance continues, to be honest. That's, I think there's a benefit there. And actually, you know, maybe I'm kind of going on political fan fiction, but if Scottish Labour can return to the kind of their progressive roots, maybe they can be part of that as well in some capacity. That's political fan fiction stuff, but who knows, to be honest? Who knows?
I'll talk about that in a later thing. So, final formal question, and then we can have a more relaxed, although my conversation's been pretty relaxed thus far. I didn't want to just have you on as the token SNP member. And I was very interested to see your positions on monetary policy, because they're a bit of a departure from how people on the left usually talk about financing government business. And one of those positions that's unusual is you've previously argued that an independent Scotland should have its own currency. So not the euro, not the pound, but an independent Scottish currency. Could you explain to us why you favour that policy?
I think I'll start off by talking about kind of the euro, and I think maybe talking to those who may be listening or not listening about, you know, why they might support the euro and its principles. I'll start by saying this. The aspirations of the euro and just the Europe as a whole, the European project, is about unifying nations together for peace, prosperity, and for shared culture. And 99% of the time, yeah, absolutely, I'm completely behind that European project. But the euro, though, as a monetary design, completely fails those principles. And rather than creating stability, euro members actually often find themselves lagging behind their neighbours who enjoy the benefits of controlling their own currency, basically their own fiscal and monetary sovereignty. And actually, on top of that as well, Euro members have become greater victims of political instability due to growing threats of the far right. You only need to look to Spain and Greece, for example, to see that kind of threat growing, like Golden Dawn, for example, in Greece. You know, the way I see it, Europe works best when we have these principles of peace, shared culture, and diversity. When we accept that actual diversity within it, not just in social terms, but economic terms as well. Each European nation has unique strengths and problems which are best addressed by the people of those countries. But rather than accept diversity, the euro forces the exact same single fixed exchange rate and interest rate on all European nations that have the euro. Whilst the euro's interest rate may work for some countries, or even the majority of those countries, many countries are actually left worse off because the rate does not reflect their individual needs. And there's no flexibility within that exchange rate for European nations. You take it or you leave it. And, you know, just let's touch on some actual data points there. Whilst, you know, many European countries have their own currencies and central banks have enjoyed unemployment rates that are generally lower, Euro nations have actually seen unemployment levels between 7 and 12% over the last decade alone. And that's not me just saying that from my general research, that's quite literally the European Central Bank's data saying that. Just for contrast, in the last decade alone, again, for the Euro, for Euro nations, unemployment is between 7 and 12%. Scotland's unemployment rate, again, Scotland, which has no fiscal or monetary sovereignty, our unemployment rate fell between 8 to 4%. And as Scotland was to become independent, our choice is, do we replicate the Euro model, which has higher unemployment levels and political instability, or do we go for our monetary and fiscal sovereign neighbours like Denmark, Sweden and Norway, who have typically lower levels? One of the big issues as well with the euro, and it's something we've seen in our own country, is the obsession with fiscal conservatives wanting to have a government deficit of 3% or less and a debt to GDP of 60% or less. And the reasoning behind this is we must balance the books, which for many of us, we know that's code for austerity. Now, there's one man who might pop to your mind who was obsessed with trying to get below 3% for a government deficit, and that was George Osborne. And after 6 years of his time as Chancellor, he did that. He got the UK government deficit to 2.8%. And that was 6 years of increasing food banks, child poverty, deteriorating mental and physical health, failing infrastructure, growing crime rate, and increasing morality. That is what that figure brought us. Now, you might be thinking to yourself, well, okay, maybe there's some academic or economic framework that was used to justify the 3% and 50% ratio targets put by George Osborne and the European Central Bank. And the truth is, there's none. There is quite literally zero academic or economic data or research to back up those targets. Those numbers, the 3% number and 50% number, were completely made up on the spot by two low-level employees at the French Ministry of Finance in 1981, and they were made up to try and reduce the aspirations of French ministers who wanted to expand spending on the economy or on welfare. There's absolutely zero scientific evidence behind the rule. And yet somehow that has been able to almost consume the euro model, those numbers, based on...
Sounds like you're saying that austerity is all the fault of the French.
I'm not trying to be the engineer from TF2, so I'm not being anti-French here. But what I will say is it's fiscal conservatives.
Is the engineer anti-French? I mean, he's very patriotic American.
There's this meme I need to share with you later on that has him as I hate the French sort of thing. Is this a meme or something like that? I need to show you.
All right. No, I'm a big TF2 person. That's why I was surprised. Obviously, it's the soldier doesn't like the spy. The spy's French.
I'll try and find it. I might be wrong. I might have goofed up the meme reference there. If I have, I do apologize. But okay,
it's just that you happen to be speaking to someone with a massive number of hours in TF2. I've heard his voice so much.
Oh, you and me both.
Yes.
Sorry.
No, that's fine. That's staying in. They've played TF2. They're all nerds.
What I will do is I'll actually touch on like a real case study. I'll touch on two. Back in 2008 is a key example of the financial crisis. And it shows the difference between what you can do without your own currency and what you can do. So we'll use Greece, for example. So in 2001, Greece abandoned the drachma and their monetary sovereignty and passed over that sovereignty to the European Central Bank. So this meant that all Greek debt was redenominated in a currency which it was not the monopoly issuer of. In other words, it does not have direct control of that currency and it can't create it. And that means that Greece was forced to use taxation and bonds to raise funds for government spending. Now, just in comparison, governments that use their own currency, I'm talking again about Sweden, Norway, Denmark, Japan, Canada, the UK, when we spend, we don't use taxation or bonds to actually spend. That comes after. When we spend, from the UK perspective, it comes from a legal account at the Bank of England called the Consolidated Fund. That fund starts each day with a zero balance. In other words, every time it spends, it's newly created public money. All spending for monetary, sovereign, and fiscal governments is new public money. And the purpose of taxes and bonds are for other purposes. Bonds are typically used to set interest rates, and taxes are to accumulate excess currency in the economy. Now, going back to Greece, when they were going to dish out Greek bonds, bondholders were actually facing a real risk of not getting paid back because Greece faced a default risk because Eurozone countries could quite literally run out of euros. And when such a risk exists, markets look at those countries like Greece and go, well, if I'm going to loan to you, I want a premium. And therefore, I'm going to put an extra interest on that bond. So I know if you get guaranteed a return, I'm getting a bit extra. So come the 2008 financial crisis, Greece, you know, all countries actually, you know, we suffered job losses, declining tax revenues, and a spike in demand for welfare because people all of a sudden are out of employment and need that government support. Greece was basically forced to push the government deficit to 15% of GDP in response to the crisis. And it had to, otherwise people were literally going to die. And many cases, many people did die. But it couldn't clear all those payments. Therefore, it had to go, basically, to the markets. It had nowhere else to go. And it couldn't control its central bank because the central bank is controlled by the EU. So it couldn't, like the UK and other countries, spend first and tax and bond issue later.
So if I was to simplify this, even from just my own brain, it was very much a case of Greece wasn't even coming up with new expansionary fiscal policy. It was literally saying, we are trying to pay the welfare payments that are just being claimed by, like, naturally, because people... We're trying to run our government and we're running out of money because it's run by the European Central Bank.
Yeah, essentially, because they don't control the currency, therefore they face a real default risk. Yeah.
Whereas when the UK faced the exact same problem, they could just say, well, we control our currency, so we will just spend this now because we control the currency. And if we need to recoup it through taxes, or not recoup it, sorry. If we feel the need to do taxes and other spending changes later, we can just do that. But at this moment, we're fine. And that was basically the difference.
The UK can do that at any point, basically, because every day, public spending, all public spending, every single bit of it, essentially, comes from newly created spending at the Bank of England. It's all new public spending. But you touched that point, so let's touch on that point about the difference there. The UK and Greece face different problems, but the main one being the bond markets. The UK government deficit increased to 10%. Again, because if we didn't do that, people were literally going to die and it was a time of crisis. And for 10-year government bonds, for us, because we control our own currency, it fell from 3.6% to 1.8%. The interest rate fell because the Bank of England essentially said, this is the base rate, you follow it or you don't get it. And for Greek bonds, however, because Greece did not have its own currency, it was completely on its knees to the bond market. And for 10-year government bonds in Greece, they increased from 6% to 35%. The markets completely shafted Greece because they couldn't control their own interest rate. They couldn't simply spend into the economy like the UK can. It just did not have the fiscal monetary control to be able to support basic citizens' human rights and needs. So that's why, for me, overall, I want to see Scotland adopt its own currency, because falling for that currency trap like the euro would be absolutely disastrous for the people of Scotland. And there's one thing you can say, and this applies to the UK, by the way, right now. So if you're not a listener to Scottish independence, this applies to you right now as well. With your own currency, with your own control of the central bank, austerity is a choice. It's not inevitable. And these fiscal rules and these ideas to balance the books to below 3% is just a way to justify austerity. But it's all based on quite literally no scientific, no economic research.
Is there anything that you would like to plug, a Twitter account or organization that you work for?
I work at Modern Money Scotland. It's a progressive heterodox economic think tank that looks at new ways to bring forward policy. I won't plug it too much because, to be honest, I'm in your podcast, and actually I want to serve these of your listeners. But if you're insane enough to follow me and or have an interest in Scottish politics, don't just follow me. If you do follow me, it's at Mammoth Whale. Just at Mammoth Whale, you'll find that. But also, if you do take a keen interest, actually follow those who I retweet, because actually many people who I retweet are bloody excellent, probably better commentators than myself. But that's my only plug. I'm not going to delve too much, because actually this is your podcast and I want to answer your questions.
Anyway, thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it. I really appreciate it. And also, on a personal level, it's been very lovely to talk to you. You seem like a very, very nice chap.
Thank you. It's been great to talk to you.
It has. I'm sure we will talk again through whatever means. Thank you again. As always, I wanted to finish by saying a particularly strong thank you to the people who have signed up as comrades on Patreon: Alex Wilson, Barry James, Bert Rothkugel, Chloe Hopkins, Chris Gravel, Conrad, Michael Murray, Mick Mikatir, Neil Barton, Patrick Lefebvre, Pavel Kazimowski, Ruth Holliday, Stephen Carr, Thomas Alexander, Juditha De Silva, and Joseph Bailey. Really wonderful people. Thank you so much, guys. You make what I do possible, and I love you for it.